This is Phil Ferrand.
And I am driving home. Couldn't get the key in the lock there for a minute. It's been a good day. It's been a good week. We had a little excitement this week. It's Thursday today. Heading home after work. We did have a little excitement this week. Tuesday night, I hop on every time we're running cycle, and I just check and make sure everything's okay. You know, once we get through it, make sure everything's balanced and we're good and blah, 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 blah. So, Tuesday night, you know, I've got costumes to work on. I've got this, that, and the other to do, and got to be about 8:30, which is a little later than I normally check, but I got tied up in... distracted in doing my editing. I wanted to get the editing done because I'm editing, doing a first pass edit on book 13 at this point. So got that under control. I was just getting ready to transition into working on Bow Tie Day. National Bow Tie Day is tomorrow. And pop my laptop open, dial into work. I have no emails that I'm supposed to... Well, there's one that says, I'm done. It's like, no, you aren't. Because first of all, that email came like almost an hour before it should have. What just happened here? I don't have the kickoff emails. I don't have anything. And so I'm starting to chase backwards, and I call my buddy who's actually takes care of that stuff now, and says, Brett, I think we got a problem. So he starts looking around. Sure enough, we had hit an error in a really odd place. And mind you, this odd place has been functioning fine for 11 years. As I'm fond of saying, that's the great thing about technology. It works until it doesn't. So it hit in an odd place. And on the basis of that, it threw some things out of whack. And lo and behold, we didn't get our first chunk done. And once we didn't get the first chunk done, there was no data for the rest of it. So... we ran our whole balancing and cycle with no data. Oof. Ran real fast, though. It ran real fast. Anyways, so we're looking at it. We're chasing it down. We're trying to figure out what happened. We're doing the thing. We're doing the thing. We're doing the thing. And so we finally figure out where we had the error, what happened, doesn't appear to be happening. At that point, we've got a choice as to whether we're going to just kick it off and try it again, or we're just going to let it float. And we decided that we would let it float. By that point, it was about 9:30. If we had kicked it off again, it would have been about 10:30, 11 o'clock before we knew what the disposition was. So all the data that we were going to put in Tuesday night, we knew we had all the data, and we just made a command decision that what we were going to do is just let that data float till the next night. There was no big demands on that data to be processed by Wednesday morning, so we talked about it, talked to the supervisors, we decided, you know what, let's just let it float. That way we'll get into a new cycle. It'll be fine. So my buddy that I had called, he did a bunch of research to see where we were. We shuffled a few pieces around. We made sure that could never touch us again. I did a little research. It seemed like we were all going to be fine. Even though there would be a gap in our cycles. You know, the night before had been cycle 14. The night last night was cycle 16. Cycle 15 was the one that, according to everything except one table, there was one table where there was an entry for cycle 15, everything else was missing. All the data control stuff, all the data migration stuff, all the reporting, everything was missing. Except that one table that had a cycle 15 entry in it. So we went ahead, we got ready to go in last night in terms of doing the data. It's all automated, so you know, we thought, well, that's fine. We were supposed to do like 113 batches on Tuesday night, and then last night we had another 94-ish, somewhere in there, 227 total. So 113 minus 227, which is 114 batches. And so she said, well, let's let it float. So we run balancing reports every night. We make sure everything balances to the penny, and we cross-check the data in a bunch of different ways. I mean, by ledger, by account, you know, by totals, by categories, by, we just cross-check it like crazy to make sure everything got through. So it's like 6 o'clock. We're getting ready to kick off this cycle at 7 o'clock-ish. And I get home, I get a little Jesus whisper. The little whisper is, you know, you really should delete that record because it's the only thing that says you had a cycle 15 and there are systems that are going to be relying on those, that table. And I went downstairs, took a look at it, paused again, tried to see if there was any objections. There wasn't. I was like, okay, we're deleting it. So I wrote my buddy and I said, hey, I'm deleting this record. So I went ahead and got rid of it because it was the only record. Turns out that was a good thing. I figured out later that was a really good thing. It would have thrown off a bunch of our balancing and we would have had to manually correct it. But last night, everything ran to completion. Everything was green across the board. It was all green and we got all caught up and yay, yay. Which meant I could not only get my writing done, I could not only get all my bills paid, which I do on Wednesday night, but I could also work on the costume, and I got everything squared away for bow tie day as well. So yay, all is well. I have like little thing to do when I get home. But aside from that, I'm ready to go. So it's a fascinating thing. You know, we love those whispers. We love those whispers. Goodness. There are so many times when those little whispers have saved my bacon. Anyways, so all is well. Writing is going along fine. I actually started my read-through last night. I was doing some editing. I was doing a quick grammar and spelling check against the thing, against the book. It's 160 some odd thousand words, so it's in manuscript, it's over 500 words, or 500 pages, I think. So I just did a quick spelling and grammar check on it all. And then last night, I actually started reading, doing my read-through before I do my Grammarly check. And that's always a little interesting because by this point, I have been away from the first few chapters of the book for 5 months. So it's a really good reset. So when I hit those first chapters again, that tells me it's almost like it's fresh to me, which is good because it gives me a chance to say, okay, is this starting where it should? And there have been times when I have rewritten that first chapter to try to get it where it should be. But last night, read through the first chapter and I was like, hey, this is fine. Yay! So start on chapter 2 tonight, read a couple of chapters maybe. And then I've got to get going on the Labor Day costume. I have some of the pieces for it. I'm building a muscle suit. At least I think I am. Oh, and I've got like 8 days now. I've got 8 days to get this muscle suit done, but I have a weekend and here. So yeah, I'm doing the whole thing where you have two body suits and then you put the foam between them, and there's all kinds of different ways to do this. I think I know how I'm doing this, but I've got all the pieces to give it a try. And so I got a bunch of gluing to do, and then I have to give it a try and figure out exactly what I'm doing. Then we'll see. And if this doesn't work, I don't know what I'm gonna do. I don't know. We'll see. I think it's gonna work. Seems like it should. It's just engineering, so I should be able to make something work. But anyways, it'll be fun. And the great thing is, it's supposed to be funny. So, you know, if it ends up looking weird and I end up looking like some kind of mutant, you know, that's fine too, because it's funny. Anyways, and people enjoy the effort, you know, so they're very kind to me. So that's good. Family is good. All is well. All is well. We are blessed. We are blessed. We are blessed. So this week, there was, first of all, I came across an article that was a celebration. It's just a celebration. It's so fun when you see stuff like this, because it's whispers, you know. Whether people recognize that it's whispers or not, it's whispers. And then in conjunction with that, there was sort of a little side tangential issue that I thought, oh, okay, so here we go. So, the title of the article is "A Math Problem Stumped Experts for 50 Years. This grad student from Maine solved it in days," which is really cool. That is really cool when that happens, when somebody comes and all of a sudden they see things from a different perspective and they get an idea and they run it down and boom, there it is. It's really cool. So I'm not going to get all the math stuff to it. I don't know. Apparently, 50 years ago, there was a brilliant young mathematician named John Horton Conway. He discovered something called a knot, K-N-O-T, knot in mathematics, but it wasn't something you'd encounter, that's K-N-O-T, not something you'd encounter in the real world. You could certainly create it out of string if you wanted to, but generally speaking, it existed only in Conway's calculations. There are thousands and thousands of these kind of conceptual tangles in a bewildering corner of mathematics known as knot theory. But even there, Conway's discovery was special. Not so much for what it was, but for what it might or might not be. Yes, that's confusing, but when talking knot theory, it's best to accept that things are going to get a little fuzzy. I'm not going to be able to explain all this because I ain't got it, but that's fine. In any case, the Conway knot is hardly remarkable at first glance, with just 11 crossings or places where it overlaps itself. It is rather nondescript by standards of higher dimensional knot theory. But the knot has one property that made it the subject of intense mathematical scrutiny. Conway, who recently died, sadly enough, he didn't get to see this thing. Maybe he did. At the age of 82 from complications of COVID-19, made innumerable contributions to the field of mathematics. Yet it was his knot that specialists would return to again and again and again and again. These decorated mathematicians were unable to find a solution to what became known as the Conway knot problem. Now then, we could spend a lot of time with me trying to describe and read and scratching my head and all that stuff. We could do that. Or you could just go read the article for yourself. There is an explanation of knot theory. I'm getting my mail, by the way. There's an explanation of knot theory in there. And I glanced at it. And it was pretty interesting. But yeah, I'm not going to... Never mind. So what is really cool about this is there's this grad school student. Then 2 years ago, a little-known graduate student named Lisa Piccirillo, who grew up in Maine, learned about the knot problem while attending a math conference. A speaker mentioned the Conway knot during a discussion about the challenges of studying knot theory. For example, the speaker said, we still don't know whether this 11 crossing knot is slice. Now, slice is some term that describes some things. We don't care. I'm specifically interested in Lisa's reaction, because I have had a similar reaction in a very specific and similar case. So need you to shoot. Oh yeah, yeah. My wife just, yeah. Okay. So I got to go in and shoot a video for my wife here real quick. So I need to finish this up. Okay. Because her reaction was, that's ridiculous, she thought while she listened. This is 2018. We should be able to do that. And a week later, she produced a proof that stunned the math world. It's like when I was talking years and years and years ago, I was talking to this company that had some software that said graphical music output, their music software. And I called them and I said, if I play on your keyboard, will it write out the music? And they said, no, but if you write a program, we'll pay you royalties. And I bust out laughing and said, thank you very much, hung up the phone. And then I back up and the thought came to me, this cannot be that hard. This is the same thing. It's the whisper. The whisper she hears is, well, that's ridiculous. This is 2018. We should be able to do that. And on the basis of that, she starts working and she follows a little whisper here and she follows, and all of a sudden she produces this result and she proves it. And she starts, you know, she starts talking to a little later. And she talks about, you know, growing up and et cetera, and how she was encouraged in mathematics, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So she, you know, she had certainly things that assisted her. It's the way her brain worked and things she had concentrated on, et cetera, et cetera. But it was so cool because it talked about the fact that, so not long after the breakthrough, Piccirillo attended a meeting with Cameron Gordon, a University of Texas math professor. When she mentioned her solution, Gordon was skeptical. He asked Piccirillo to walk him through the steps. Quote, this is from her, then he made me write it all down, like all up on the board, she recalls. And then he got very excited and started yelling because she had actually cracked it. She had cracked it. Very cool. Piccirillo submitted her solution to the Annals of Mathematics, and the prestigious math journal agreed to publish her paper. When I asked James Favre, a Yale postdoc, to explain the significance of having a paper published in the Annals, he laughed for several seconds. He said, it's head and shoulders the most important and influential journal in mathematics, he says. That's why I'm laughing. It's amazing, and it's so cool. It's so cool. So congratulations to this mathematician who coincidentally happens to be a young lady. Congratulations. She solved something really cool. I mean, she does say later that, you know, she was happy that she was able to get this. And she said, when I asked her about her goals, Piccirillo said one of her priorities is to help grow and broaden the mathematics community. Quote, there are certainly There certainly are many young women, people of color, non-heterosexual, non-binary gender people who feel put at an arm's length by the institution of mathematics, she said. It's really important to me to help mitigate that in many small ways that I can. One important way to do that, she continues, is to help shatter the myth of math prodigy. When universities organize math conferences, she said, they should avoid inviting speakers who give talks where they go really fast and then try to show you how smart they are and how hard their research is. That's not good for everyone, especially it's not good for young people or people who are feeling like maybe they don't belong there. What those people in the audience don't know, she says, is that nobody really understands it either. Quote, you don't have to be really smart, whatever that means, to be a successful mathematician, which that's some news to me. She says there's this idea that mathematicians are geniuses. A lot of them seem to be child prodigies that do these Olympiads. In fact, you don't have to come from that background at all to be very good at math. And most mathematicians, including many of the really great ones, don't come from that sort of background. As Piccirillo herself proves, some of them even go on to produce work that alters the course of mathematics. Now, so that's the first thing I found really interesting about this article, is just congratulations, congratulations, congratulations. I think it's fabulous. This is obviously a very analytical person. It's very focused, and is someone whose brain works well. Okay, she's trying to say she's not a genius, but obviously she's good at analyzing, she's good at conceptualizing, she's good at imaging things in her brain. I mean, obviously she's good at this because she worked this out. What was interesting to me is she was asked about being a female. She said, and she said she had a mentor named Grigsby. And she said of Grigsby, she really encouraged me. No. Yes. Eli really pushed me. Okay, it says she. I don't know. She really encouraged me. Eli really pushed me into trying another math class and then liking the next class. I'd already started on a progression. By her senior year, she was taking graduate level topology courses. After graduating in 2013, she chose to pursue her doctorate at the University of Texas because of the university's excellent topology program and its reputation as a great place for female math students. In 2014, just 28.9% of the math and science doctorates were awarded to women, according to the National Science Foundation. But at Texas, something like 40% of graduate math students were women. By and large, Piccirillo has felt welcomed and encouraged as a female mathematician. Quotes, but now and again, things happen, she tells me. For example, in grad school, I would receive notes in my department mailbox commenting on my appearance. Okay, well. What's interesting about this is they have a picture of her, and she is attractive. Picture of her. So here's this serious mathematician, an attractive young woman, could be dressed in everything. I don't know who chose what she wore, but I just think this is part of this really interesting thing about the interaction of the species and interaction of the genders. She has on a reddish dress. I'm not really good with describing colors, but it's not quite red. It's a little maroon, but it's a very active color. It's sleeveless, which is fine. It's short, so it is, you know, well above the knee. And she's standing there with her hand on her hip, with one leg cocked out a little bit in kind of the standard female pose. Okay, well, that's fine. Anybody can wear whatever they want. They can pose anywhere they want. But the fact is, we as human beings, we operate on two levels. You know, we operate on a rational, intellectual level, and then we operate on subsystem levels. Now then, she is an attractive young lady, so you're going to get some subsystem response from men no matter what you wear. And one of the stories I love about all this kind of stuff is My daughter and I were talking about this one day, and I was explaining to her the differences in outfits and how men interpret thing as opposed to how women interpret thing. And often women interpret the word cute as, oh, that's cute. And what is really underneath the surface is, oh, that will catch a guy's eye, or that will, you know, or it may just be cute, depending on how it's, you know. And so we were talking about specifically an empire waist, which an empire waist, in case you don't know, is a high waist. It doesn't sit down at the waist. It sits farther up, right underneath the breast. And it tends to tuck in underneath the breast to kind of accentuate the breasts a little bit. And then it flows down from there. Now then, I was maintaining to her that the reason an empire waist is more alluring and more eye-catching than a waist that sits where it normally is because it means that the fabric flounces more. And it means that the fabric could lift up unencumbered by this waist because the band that's holding this fabric down, you know, that is higher. And so it's easier to get underneath this skirt. In other words, there's easier access. And I said, you know, one of the reasons that guys like empire waist is because there is this subsystem response in them that the access is easier. And my daughter told me later, she said that she was getting dressed to go someplace, maybe church something. And she said, you know, she kind of got her stuff out and she saw the little dress and she was like, oh yeah, that's cute. And then she realized it's got an empire waist and she was like, oh yeah, okay, that's why it's cute. So not to say that she can't wear an empire waist. That's fine. It's just you have to understand that there is going to be subsystem responses. I mean, I wear outfits all the time that are designed to get subsystem responses. And there are different subsystem responses from different people. And that's fine too. I mean, when I put on the little, you know, ruffles and Lolita dress that I built for Mother's Day, I knew I was going to get a variety of subsystem responses. I knew the women would think it's the most hysterical thing in the world. It was all pink and fluffs and bows and petticoats and, you know, bloomers and white shiny hose and the whole bit. And I knew they were going to think it was hysterical, and it was for them. But I also knew I was going to get subsystem responses from men, and from some of the men, there was going to be a disgust response. I knew that, which is fine. I wore it anyways. So I'm not saying anybody should not wear something because they're afraid of subsystem responses. I'm just saying we should just be aware of subsystem responses. And she had mentioned, the mathematician, you know, in this article that sometimes she'd get notes about her appearance. Okay, well, you know, if she's wearing stuff like she wore in the picture, that's going to evoke subsystem responses. That doesn't mean anything about she deserves to be attacked. And I'm not saying that. I'm saying it's just part of biology that there are going to be subsystem responses to that. First of all, it's an active color. It wasn't straight red, but it was close. It was a close cousin of red. Second of all, it's sleeveless. So there's gapping underneath, you know, the shoulder area. So there's, you know, gap, and that kind of attracts the eye because maybe I'll see something I'm not supposed to see. Third of all, it's short. So, you know, the higher you get up on the leg, the more interest you're going to get, the more subsystem response you're going to get, because guys are thinking, oh, it's not too far now to the fun place, you know. Fourth, she's got her leg cocked out a little bit. Well, when you cock out your leg a little bit, you actually pull the fabric up, so there's more of a gap between your legs. That's going to cause a subsystem response. Plus, your legs are making an upside-down V. Well, where does the tip of that V point? It points right to your vagina, if you're a woman. So, of course, you're going to get a subsystem response from that, because the human brain will see that upside-down V, and it will track and it will think where it's going. I mean, this is just guys. This is just visual responses. They're not lusting. This is just a subsystem response. And then finally, she has her hand on her hip. And she's got her arm cocked out. Now, what does that do? You see this pose a lot from women, all ages, that if they're trying to kind of, you know, as one of my friends at Walmart says, sexy pose, they will cock their leg, you know, lift their heel a little bit, put their hand on their hip, shove their hip out a little bit. The reason they're shoving their hip out a little bit is because it accentuates the curve from the hip into the waist. And one of the things that men from a subsystem response do is they look for the shape of that curve. Men typically prefer a 75% ratio in that curve. So that's one thing it's doing. First of all, when you put your hand on your hip, you're exposing the area on the flank so that it's easier, it's much easier to see what the shape of that curve is. That's one thing. And the second thing that's happening is when you put your hand on your hip like that, what you're doing is you're forming a general triangle that starts at the wrist, goes up to the elbow, comes across, comes down the side of the body. And the point of that triangle is pointing right at the vagina. So, and all these things are subsystem responses. Okay, so, you know, I can understand why maybe she was getting some notes in her mailbox about her appearance. That's not to say that there was anything wrong with her wearing anything she's wearing, but subsystem responses are a part of life. They're just a part of life. And my wife is wondering about my ETA. Just a second. Let me tell her, just finishing up now. Up podcast. Be right in. So, okay, just a second. Be right in. So, I gotta go. I gotta record something for my wife. Subsystem responses. You know, I think we should just be aware of them. Again, congratulations to this young lady for coming up with this proof. This is fabulous. I'm so glad she listened to the whispers and made a run for it. It's just so great. But at the same point, even though you're a rational, even-keeled, you know, intelligent person, sometimes those subsystem responses can be happening underneath the surface and you just don't even recognize they're happening. So we should be more aware of those. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.